Hello, and welcome to episode 129 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a policy analyst, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Today's episode is my interview with Kristen Henning about her book, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. Kristen Henning has been representing children accused of crime in Washington, D.C. for more than 25 years and is a nationally recognized trainer and consultant on the intersection of race, adolescence, and policing. Henning was previously the lead attorney of the juvenile unit at the D.C. Public Defender Service and now serves as the Bloom Professor of Law and director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative at Georgetown Law. She's also the author of the book, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth, which she is here to discuss with me today. Welcome to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Kristen Henning.
Thank you so much, Josh. I appreciate it.
I would be remiss in saying that it's really extra special to have you here now, because we've actually had to make a couple of runs at this because of internet problems and stuff like that, but we'll try to make the best of it anyway, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I always ask the same first question: how did you get from wherever you started in life to where you were a public defender for over 25 years and writing books about the criminalization of Black youth?
Well, I think it starts with the fact that I came from a family that really cared, one, about social justice and about young people. My mother made her career in early childhood education, and my father, although he was a businessman, he also worked with young people in our church. He would have the young boys from the neighborhood over on Friday nights, to talk about life. And so I think that's a lot of it. I came from a family of teachers and preachers, and but my real aha moment came during my freshman year of college. I had an apprenticeship at the local courthouse in juvenile court. And I will never forget the first day of that internship. I walked into the courthouse, walked down the hall, and saw a line of children chained together at their legs and at their arms. And I just was shocked that we shackle children in contemporary America. And of course, most of those children were predominantly, or disproportionately, I should say, Black and brown. And that was just, that really stopped me in my tracks. And when I entered the courthouse and met the prosecutor assigned to juvenile court, I said to her, "I really want to be over there." And I pointed across the room to the defense table. And I said, "I want to be sitting with the kids." She said, "Sure, one day, I'll introduce you to the defenders." But that was my aha moment.
Since you have a public defense background, maybe a good place to start is discussing kind of the recent attack that's been going on the idea of public defense. I think, it was most heard during the recent confirmation hearings for Ketanji Brown Jackson. Do you have any thoughts about the kind of this idea that even the idea of defending people is problematic?
Yeah, I mean, this notion that somehow, Ketanji Brown Jackson was somehow at fault for defending someone of any type of offense, but the go-to attack is usually around sexual offenses, right? As if anyone in this country should go without a defense, right? When everyone is entitled to a presumption of innocence at the front end and due process, a meaningful opportunity to be heard and to test evidence, right, against them. And so that's really, fundamental to what we believe. It's the entire framework upon which our justice system, our legal system was built. And so to question that in any way is extraordinarily problematic. And we want to bring down the weight of the state through the police department and the prosecutors who have inordinate amounts of money to devote to this enterprise. And yet, the notion that somehow it would be wrong to have ever been defending someone who's accused is so extraordinarily problematic.
And as a person of color who is a law professor and, you know, has been involved in a lot of work around these kind of areas for a long time. Do you have any other thoughts about those hearings a few months ago or a few weeks ago and the process?
Well, just that the, you know, it's disappointing in so many ways to watch the politicization of the of this institution in the ways in which it has. I, you know, in quite, you know, a naive way, as starting off my legal career as a young lawyer, and, you know, really for quite some time, honestly, maybe I was disabused only recently with the confirmation hearings, but just buying into the notion that the United States Supreme Court was the neutral arbiter, right? And I, you know, I wanted so deeply to believe that. And if that one pivotal institution is no longer a neutral body, then what does the rest of justice look like, right? Justice seems to now turn on, certainly I've always felt that at the state and local level, that justice turns on what we say, who you get, what judge you get, what prosecutor you get, what defense attorney you get, undermining in every way the rule of law. And there's no safety or security that you will have a fair and equitable opportunity to defend oneself in these moments. And now to think about even the highest court of the land really turning on who you get in a particular season in which these pivotal cases are being decided, really is frightening.
Yeah, you know, I mean, for some reason or another, when I was younger, I came into contact with enough postmodernism to always be innately suspicious of the ideas of neutrality and objectivity. Yes. And so I'm not sure I was there about them being, you know, neutral per se. I think
people right.
bring themselves to everything they do is the way I would probably talk about it. And before we get to the book, since we're talking about the Supreme Court, obviously this is a very tough week, the last week and a half since the leak of the Alito, decision, for lack of a better term, the trial balloon about Roe versus Wade. Is there anything you would like to say about that before we dive into to your book?
I mean, there's just so much to say. I mean, I don't even, you know, even putting aside the content, right? Like the ways in which we can undo, you know, individual rights of women, putting even that aside, just the tying it to this notion of the politicization of the courts is that we as a country can't move forward with consistency and reliability about fundamental rights when we have a decision that is so deep in our legal system to get upturned in an instant based upon some recent, you know, judicial justice appointment to that court, I think is also frightening. I am not one who believes that never, ever, ever, you know, should we ever, you know, overturn precedent. We had to, you know, overturn precedent in some significant ways with Brown versus Board of Education and, you know, the internment camps. You know, there have been moments, but this isn't that moment. Like, it isn't that moment. It's not of that, you know, caliber. It's an undoing of rights, fundamental right to privacy, in ways that were very political. Right.
And there's so, also, it seems to me, like I heard someone say something that I thought was a fairly interesting idea, which is this notion that someone could exercise a right 1 week and be right. put in prison for using that same power a week later.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, it's absolutely a powerful statement and astute for this moment. And that goes to my notions of consistency and reliability. One can't, you know, make decisions about one's life, you know, with that type of upheaval, with the stroke of a pen. And it's more than the stroke of a pen, right? With the appointment of certain justices to a court. And that, to me, is what is terrifying. The fundamental premises upon which we can undo years-long precedent is now question. I think that's what's frightening.
So you wrote the book, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth, which is powerful, but also really hard to read in a lot of ways. before we kind of get into specifics, I did want to ask one question. It seems to me that you can draw a line from the cover of the book back to Public Enemy's iconography. Was that to some, was that purposeful at all, or just kind of happened that way?
No, yeah, probably just happened that way, though I do write about, hip hop and music. I don't think I take on Public Enemy, though I love Public Enemy and talk about them often. But
one of the biggest, one of my biggest Twitter moments ever was when Chuck D followed me. That was the
that's pretty big. I can't lay claim to that one. That'd be wonderful. That said, though, no, I think the covers was indeed very intentional, but very much so about the ways in which Black youth are targeted, right? And it's got, as you can see both in your book shot behind your head and behind mine, that we've got, a Black child with a book bag with a target, as if it were target practice on his back. In that particular instance, it's a little boy.
One of the most famous cases that, that everybody knows about was a kid who was arrested for stealing a book bag.
Oh, right. Khalif Browder. Yeah. So that wasn't connected up either. It's just so, I love these. Now you're giving me more to talk about on the road and what the cover could mean, but in all seriousness.
That the reason why Public Enemy used that iconography is very similar to the reason why you're using it. So I think that maybe there's a spiritual kinship there, if nothing else.
There we go. I'm going to have to look this up and reach out.
Yeah. So the thing that always gets me thinking about this topic, like the thing that I can't get my mind past, there's a lot of things that upset me, but I think the thing that since it happened, I've never been able to get past is the case of Tamir Rice. My feeling is that we are and have been in an incredibly bad place in this country. If a young boy can't play in a playground with a toy gun without getting shot dead within 5 seconds by police, I've unfortunately watched that video way too many times, and it's still just I can't process it correctly. Right. Can you use this example to kind of ground your work and kind of what the book is about?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, because it allows me to sort of highlight some of the key themes of the book, all of which are, evident in that story, starting with the criminalization of normal adolescence. And so you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the idea that a child of any race or class can't play, right, is in and of itself a huge revelation and problem for our country. And the ways in which I learned a lot in writing this book about the extraordinary developmental benefits of recreation, play, and leisure. And it is something that I think I and so many of us take for granted. You think about these last 2 years and how difficult it's been for all of us as adults in the pandemic, and the absolute need for just to be able to walk outside and breathe, for a moment of being able to relax and laugh and whatever it is, whether it's watch TV, even with the mask, seeing friends when the summer hit, going outside and having a picnic in the backyard. All of those were essential for our mental health as adults. Think about how much more so that's for children. And so I began to realize and study about these developmental benefits. Play is not only essential for physical exercise and growth, but it is also essential for that mental reprieve, that life is stressful for all of us, and that play gives a child a chance to put life in perspective, to have the pressure off, and just enjoy. So that's one thing. The other thing, we know that that play, recreation, and leisure also contribute to social dynamics, right? It teaches leadership skills and how to work well with others. And, it teaches young people to figure out what they're good at, whether it's athletics or being creative and playful. So all these things are part and parcel of how we grow up to be good, healthy adults. And so we're depriving Black children in particular of these moments of this essential developmental stage of play, recreation, and leisure. And so that's one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I think on the one side, you kind of have this, you know, thing where, you know, I think they call it the opposite of free range kids or wherever, where kids aren't allowed to, you know, go out, be away from their parents, do any of the things that we did when we were probably kids. And then right. on the other side, you have this thing where kids are being seen as the problem. And so they're not allowed to. It's like in no, it's like you wonder, where can kids be kids? You know,
and that's right. That's right. There's no safe space. I mean, Tamir Rice was in a park, the quintessential place for play, right? You know, and I say all the time, you know, kids aren't safe in school. Kids aren't, you know, to play and experiment in school anymore. Kids aren't, you know, it's not safe for them to sit on their corner, right, in their stoop, on their front porch, you know, in Black and brown communities that are heavily policed, that even that, like I write a lot in the book about other examples of play, right, or just does the whole recreation after school, kids very often convene at a local restaurant, the local Rita's Ice, the local McDonald's, and they, you know, wait, walk home to school and they hang out in front of those places. And that are, you know, we see children after children, you know, being arrested in those spaces for, I had a child arrested for incommoding. I'm like, what in the world is incommoding? I don't even know what that is. Turns out it was blocking passage. It's a fancy term for blocking passage so that people couldn't get in the front door. Are you kidding me right now? You know, just ask the kid to move. So if a customer needs to go in, those kinds.
Well, and then we also have this other kind of facet of this, which is that often for, you know, reasons, which I'm sure you can expound on, Black and brown kids are often one of the things you'll hear after an incident like that, or Michael Brown or any of the, you know, other ones is, well, they looked old for their age, or, right. you know, they're right. they're big for their age or something like
That's
that.
Right.
What is that one of the issues, too?
Yeah. So one of the second themes beyond this notion of play is the notion of bias, right? And the ways in which exactly you said, you know, so with Tamir Rice, the officers were interviewed and they kept saying that Tamir looked older than his age. And they focused it on his, you know, size 36 pants and his extra large jacket and said he's 5 feet, how many ever inches tall. And as if they could not see this baby face, this 12-year-old baby face that we see in images. And so the speed with which they approach, I mean, he was shot in less than 3 seconds, and they did not allow themselves, you know, to register, you know, him at all. But the point is, the research shows that even if they had, research shows that Black children are perceived both by law enforcement and by civilians to be significantly older than they actually are. More than 4.5 years older than they actually are. So you think about a 12-year-old Tamir, I mean, he's perceived to be 16, almost 17 years old. Then, you know, think about a 16-year-old Black youth perceived to be 20, 21. So the complete adultification. And similar research has been done with Black girls as well, finding that adults tend to perceive Black girls as older, more mature, more knowledgeable about adult topics, more adult-like in the way they carry themselves, less innocent, less in need of protection. And so the bias is significant, particularly as it relates to children. And I should just tell you one last study, really, really powerful study that fully demonstrates the purported cognitive association between Blackness and criminality. There's one study finding that people are more likely to misperceive a toy, a baby's rattle, as a gun when it is held by a black face as young as 5 years old, that even then, and that's a powerful association, right? So it's really a profound impact on what's happening with children.
So we've got this. So we've got, in one part, we've got, you know, people who are terrified to have their kids be out or doing anything for a number of reasons. On the other hand, we've got the kind of criminalization of youth. And then we've also got these massively, in the last, you know, decade or two decades, this growth of the surveillance state And, you know, even because of school shootings, it's even gone into schools. And so people grow up kind of constantly under suspicion, surveilled, harassed. This creates kind of for lack of a better term, a kind of an ongoing wound that, you know, you're living through kind of an unfreedom in a way. Almost a kind of trauma. One of the stories you share is the story of Shikara and Naya. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
So, yeah. So so in that context, Shikara and Naya Kinney are children, two girls, Black girls at Spring Valley High School in South Carolina, in Spring Valley South. It's a Spring Valley High School, maybe in Columbia, South Carolina. I'm misremembering. But the point here is, one of the themes you talked about is the surveillance, the hyper surveillance. And I think so many of us, or so many, you know, folks, particularly in middle class, grew up in schools without heavy police surveillance. And now, you know, Black children walk into the front door and automatically are greeted by a flank of police officers in uniform with weapons and go through metal detectors and the like. And so here in Shikara's story, so Shikara was in her math class, and they were taking a test, and her math teacher saw her on her phone. Well, the math teacher purportedly went up to her and said, you know, put your phone away. She didn't do so immediately. And so he calls for assistance at the front office, and the front office sends a school deputy. School deputy comes to the classroom and literally physically rips Shikara from her seat, right? In front of the entire class. Naya Kinney is relevant because she stops and records this incident. And that's how it became a national story, because she recorded this encounter. And so again, more themes. One, you know, this notion of children being under the constant surveillance of police, that the over-reliance on police for routine discipline of children, routine school discipline. Also, the use of excessive force, right? The violence, both with Tamir Rice and with Shikara, why is that a necessary response? Even if police intervention were necessary in those moments, why do we default to tasers, dog bites, body slam procedures like the one that was used to Shikara, guns? Why are we shooting, you know, at children, in the pretty long list of children who've been killed by the police in the last couple of years? Why are we resorting to any of that as a response? It goes back to our earlier point, children aren't safe, Black children aren't safe. And if you want me to talk about trauma, that's a whole nother scenario. I have an entire chapter on trauma associated with police presence.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's also interesting that Naya got in trouble for, in essence, reversing the surveillance on the officer. Is that?
That's right.
So like, even, you know, in a sense, trying to destate, you know, to use the same kind of surveillance to protect people can get into trouble.
That's absolutely right. And we see that. That's very common, where the police officers consider it disrespectful, inappropriate, you know, and times even criminal to be recording them. And so no doubt she actually got arrested. She got, Naya Kinney was arrested, and she, because of her age, got charged as an adult, even though she's a student in high school, right? And she got charged for disturbing schools, was one of her charges. And so other kids across the country get charged with interfering with a police officer for doing absolutely what is their right and what's pretty much essential to protect the rights and interests of children.
So many times you can't go out. When you can go out, you're probably being surveilled. You might be harassed. You might be thrown on the ground. You might want to, you know, this, that, you know, the other. And you can't even express yourself through kind of the traditional means that most of us, I certainly did when I was a young kid. I used to be a punk rock kid and have crazy hair and wear, you know, stuff like that. But that's also not being allowed. In many cases, the actual wearing of clothes becomes the justification for arrest. I think, you know, for instance, that Geraldo said that Trayvon Martin's hoodie was as responsible for his death as George Zimmerman. And you have other stories about people who are criminalized for the kind of hair they have, or, you know, the way that, yes. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So one of the significant themes in the book is the criminalization of normal adolescent behavior. So I ask people, think about, what did you care most about when you were a teenager? And people invariably talk about the clothes that I wore, the music that I listened to, the parties that I got invited to, you know, the friends that I had. Those were the things that young people care a lot about. And so, but you think about when much of that is penalized for Black and Brown children. So you talked about clothing, for example, and I think about the hippie era, right? With bell bottoms and tie dyes. Nobody ever criminalized those clothes, even though they were associated with, you know, drugs, hallucinogens, and things of that nature. Think about the goth era, where folks were wearing all black. Young people wore all black attire and straight dark black hair. None of that was criminalized, even when that became associated with some mass shootings. And then think about the steel-toed Doc Martens that people wear today with red shoelaces, right? And profess to associate that with white supremacy in some way. Again, never outlawed, never criminalized. Yet we see Black children wearing sagging pants. No, I don't want to see any kids' underwear either, but is it a criminal offense? Should we be responding to that as if it's a criminal offense that warrants arrest, prosecution, and detention? And that's the disparity we receive. And mind you, it is absolutely a racial distinction, because Justin Bieber, you know, is known, you know, as a fashion, you know, or an icon, certainly a pop culture icon. And he has his pants sagging and talks about with great pride how he has his pants sagging, and nobody would arrest him. And so that's, you know, one example. Another really good example is music, right? And we think about country, heavy metal, rock, pop music, all of which has the same misogynistic, violent themes that at times glorify drugs and alcohol and other things that we don't want our children to endorse. But those songs are popular and win awards without any consequence. And then you think about rap music and certain genres of hip hop, and those are demonized as if it's the most dangerous music alive. And as if somehow, you know, causing people to commit crimes, when, and it ignores so much of the beauty in that music and the pride and the political statements, positive political statements in that music. But my point here is the ways in which those normal features, important features of adolescence, are differentially treated for Black children than for white children in ways that criminalize them.
And one of the examples that you give in the book is the Mystic Valley Regional Charter School, what they did with Maya and Deanna Cook.
So those are two Black girls in Massachusetts who were adopted by white parents. And during sort of their self-exploration, as they were coming into their own identity, they began to learn more about their African-American heritage. And one of the things they decided to do was to have braids added to their hair, extensions. And these girls were told to remove their braids. And if they didn't, they would be suspended, you know, excluded from their extracurricular activities and suspended from school. And again, we see that across the country, that just the normal features that the hair, Black hair, has been criminalized. I mean, so much so that across the country, there's been the Crown Act has been adopted, which is a statutory prohibition on discrimination on the basis of hair, particularly hair associated with certain racial and ethnic groups. And the fact that we have to have some statutory piece that says that is so disturbing. And it's as if, and look, those were the girls, you know, Mia, that were criminalized, and they're not alone. Black boys, people remember Dre, they called him Dre, was his nickname, out of New Jersey, the wrestler who had his hair in dreadlocks. And the referee for the wrestling match insisted that he cut it off before he could continue with the wrestling match. And the argument was that the hair violated the rules, saying that it was too long. And the reality is that white boys who had long hair were not told to cut their hair. So it was clearly a racialized statement. But these are such important pieces for Black youth: hair, clothes, friends, music. And we're really depriving Black children of the opportunity to be Black kids, just to be kids.
A lot of ways, I think, when I hear not only white people, but a lot of white people talk about this, it comes up as something about, you know, what's been called respectability, culture. I think for a long time, Bill Cosby was associated with that. There's some other people have, and you heard a lot more of it coming out kind of after the Will Smith episode at the right. Oscars. There's also this kind of notion that if people are showing identity in a certain way, that somehow they're not representing themselves correctly and should be disciplined for that. Is that?
Yeah. So this notion of respectability politics, this internal, the ways in which even within the African-American community, the elders or, certain parents or more conservative voices within the Black community say to young people that they should conform to mainstream society and should not wear their hair as in braids or in dreadlocks or the like. And what we find, though, I think is a really nuanced examination of what's really happening. On some level, I think these are also safety politics. In other words, Black elders and Black parents think that they can protect their children from harm, from getting shot, and from getting excluded from opportunities like education and employment by dressing in their Sunday best and looking like traditional mainstream America. But here's the problem with that. I think young people see for themselves that throughout history, including the civil rights era, that Black folks dressed in their Sunday best did not avoid discrimination and did not avoid violence, right? And so they know that the safety politics doesn't work. Also, there's a body of folks within the Black community who profess this respectability politics, I think in some ways, out of their own prejudices, right? Out of their own complicity in some of this implicit racial bias, right? And what it is that dreadlocks mean, what it is that sagging pants mean when they don't mean that at all, right? That they are the precursor to violence and to, an unproductive life, when we also know that just simply is not true. And so I think it's just so much more of a complicated story, and that we have to figure out, why is it that we demonize certain adolescent culture, but we don't demonize tie-dyes and baggy pants, tie-dye and bell bottoms during the hippie era. And I think one of the other things that's worth noting is all the ways in which Black culture has been appropriated by mainstream media and white media, by the artistic culture of America for their own economic gain, right? So that, again, Justin Bieber wearing sagging pants is like a thing, right? Among white kids. And there was a time when white girls would braid their hair to look like, extensions as well. All of that is fine. It's when it's demonizing Black kids. And so I think it's really important that respectability politics misses the point in a lot of ways.
Yeah, there's kind of a famous bit from the movie Do the Right Thing where Spike Lee's character is talking with the guy he works with, who's pretty much a racist, and he brings up that the guy, all of his favorite people are, but why do you act like that when everyone you like is a Black performer, your favorite musician, your favorite basketball,
right,
your favorite, it's a really good primer for this part of the discussion. Now, I know when I was a kid, if I did something wrong, I would get sent to the guidance counselor. I mean, I'm sure everybody has seen the movie The Breakfast Club.
Right.
You might get detention, or you might get, you know, some kind of school service, but that's not how schools operate anymore. I think you refer to entering schools as like entering prisons now. I know a little bit about entering prisons, but not so much about entering schools. Do you want to talk a little
bit? Yeah. So, I mean, truly, when I go in to a local school, the front door looks a whole lot like the front door of a detention facility. And so, for example, with a weapon at their side, they get wanded, their bags get searched, and it looks a whole lot like what it looks like to enter a detention facility. And, you know, school resource officers exist now in all 50 states. And I, you know, I have to say there's a racialized history with that. I bought into, accepted for the longest time, the often repeated narrative that we have police in schools now because parents and teachers were afraid to send their children to school after the mass shooting in Columbine in 1999. But as I did research for this book, I realized that the first police in schools appeared in Indianapolis in 1939. With the earliest conversation about even the possibility of integrating schools. Then police in schools increase exponentially in the 1960s, right? Or in the civil rights era under the guise of facilitating a safe passage for meaningful integration of schools. But we know from the iconic record and from, or the iconic photograph and the historical record that very often, or far too often, police presence was an impediment to meaningful integration of schools. Fast forward to 1991, we now had by then so many police in schools that the National Association of School Resource Officers was founded with national conferences, a mission statement, and the like. Fast forward again to 1994, still 6 years or 5 years before the mass shooting in Columbine, and we have the Federal Cops in Schools framework created, which was the framework that allowed the federal government to funnel in money to states and eventually localities that would hire school resource officers, right? And what's happened in the mid-1990s, it's the super predator myth is alive, right? That is explicitly targeting Black children. And the myth was that Black children would run amok and rape, maim, and kill, you know, much of America if we didn't do something to intervene. And so even after that myth was disproven, and even after Princeton professor John DiUlio recanted that myth, the narrative that grew out of that still lives on in the American psyche, such that, you know, teachers and school counselors are afraid of children, of Black children in particular. And so that accounts for, in many ways, why it is that that schools look like prisons or detention facilities in so many ways.
So often when we talk about public safety, we talk as if it works the same for every person and family in every place. In other words, we kind of rarely ask questions about who is being kept safe by the things that we do. You talk a lot in the book about families who are afraid to even call the police, or your clients who are conflicted about calling for help, even when people they cared about were in danger. What are, you know, we've got all these things we're saying kids can't be kids, they can't do this, they can't do that, they can't do the other, they can't have hair, they can't wear clothes, they can't listen to music, they can't even be free in their schoolrooms, you know, and on top of that, they've been, you know, depending on where they lived, harassed for, you know, or, you know, every single day, to the point where the faith in the whole idea of the police comes into you know, question in their head. You have a chapter called Policing as Trauma. Can you talk more about this?
Absolutely. I was so moved by what I've seen my clients experience. And I opened that chapter with a story of my client I call Kevin. And I was sitting in my very office that I'm in now, and we get a phone call from that client saying, is there a warrant for my arrest? And we thought the question was really odd because we had actually just been to court with that client the day before. And had there been a warrant, certainly the police would have, you know, taken him that day. And so we asked more questions and we could hear his mother in the background yelling, boy, you're just being paranoid. No police officer is out there waiting for you. It turns out that he had been sitting in his window for 2 hours and he could see a police car parked out front. And he was convinced that the police were waiting to arrest him the second he walked out of there. And, you know, for somebody, any of you listening who doesn't really understand what it is like to grow up in Kevin's neighborhood, you might be thinking, well, if he hadn't done anything wrong or if he's not doing anything worthy of being arrested, then he shouldn't be worried. But what we don't realize is that Kevin has lived in a neighborhood where he's been stopped more than 50 times in his very young, teenage life for doing nothing at all. You know, he gets stopped on his way into the convenience store, on the way out, gets stopped and searched while he's sitting, you know, in a folding chair with his friends in front of his apartment complex. And so, having done one, crime in the past, having used drugs as a teenager, doesn't then thereby give police the right to stop you all day. So what I realized when his mom said, boy, you're just being paranoid, I was like, you know, he's not paranoid, he's just traumatized. And so I began to do the research on trauma. And what I found was there's a growing body of research documenting the extraordinary psychological trauma that Black and Latino children in particular experience in contact with the police, especially during those adolescent years. The research shows that Black and Latino children who live in heavily surveilled neighborhoods or who are the target of significant stops and frisk report high rates of fear, anxiety, depression, helplessness. They become hypervigilant, meaning that they're always on guard and not trusting others. And that, and in particular, not trusting police officers, and that distrust of police officers carries over to other adult figures like teachers and counselors. And the research is also powerful because it shows that, that the trauma occurs not just from being the direct target of that police contact, but also from witnessing it or hearing about it among young among friends and family. And so it's really much more devastating than I think most people realize. I will have officers say to me, oh, I just stopped and asked him questions. You know, I didn't, you know, frisk him. I didn't touch his physical body, not realizing that even that stop, even that kind of questioning is in and of itself traumatic. And most of us take it for granted that we can walk through our own neighborhoods, right? And not be subject to undue intrusion by the police. But that is just simply not for so many Black and Brown children in certain pockets of our country.
Well, and to go back to the cover of the book, you know, I mean, if you look at the cover of the book, you know, the way the perspective is, you know, you are thinking from outside, look at that kid who's a target. But if you reverse it and think about the kid always being the target, it's a whole different thing. And I think you shared the story of a 14-year-old, you know, when people are saying, well, they must have done something. You share the story of a 14-year-old, Tremaine McMillan, who the police accused of making dehumanizing stares. You know, I mean, these, right. the pretexts that people use for these stops, you know, as frustrating as the rest of this. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, and again, it ties back to the criminalization of normal adolescence and our perspective on and perception of a Black child. So, I mean, Tremaine McMillan was like a child at the beach on 4th of July, you know, in Florida. And he was roughhousing, literally tussling on a beach like two children do. He and another friend of his who were at the beach together, just tussling and having a good time, play fighting. And a police officer comes up on his ATV and is like, where's your mother? You know, you need to leave, or And literally, like any child would do, they're like, for what? What did I do? And the officer claimed that he was, quote unquote, making dehumanizing stares and balling up his fist. Well, I don't know about any of you out there, but have you seen a kid who thinks something is unfair? They huff and they puff, right? And they're emotional and they're reactive. They do what teenagers do. That's what they do. And but he got, you know, literally arrested, taken to the ground, put in a chokehold, and you know, Tremaine was holding a little puppy, and his puppy, you know, gets, you know, smashed up under, you know, the takedown. I mean, it's just appalling. And their reaction, the officer's reaction in subsequent news interviews, like it is in so many places across the country. Well, if he had just obeyed, if he had just complied, wait, I'm sorry, what part of he was a teenager did you forget? Right.
Like, but it's also like, not like he wasn't complying. He was right. Complying. He just wasn't happy about it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Perfect.
You know, I mean, I get in a lot of trouble sometimes because everybody loves the character Batman. You talk about this a little bit in the book too. I personally have never been a fan of Batman. Not that the storytelling's bad or the movies are bad, but it seems to me like it's propaganda. It's an attempt to normalize tough on crime narratives, vigilantism, and kind of justify kind of that kind of violence. We just had like the 20th retelling in a movie of that story.
Right.
But I feel like this plays out generally a lot more like what happened to Jordan Davis. And you kind of put this all in context for us.
Jordan Davis playing loud music, right? Like that's the narrative there. And the ways in terms of vigilantism, right? That the ways in which we as a society have demonized Black children for their normal adolescent behavior is not just police officers in a blue uniform, but also civilians, right? And so he's, you know, literally at a gas station in a car with some friends. I want to say that was over Thanksgiving weekend, right? Or, you know, the Thanksgiving holiday. And, you know, his friend is playing his music too loud in the car in which they're riding, and not too loud, playing it loud. A gentleman comes up, parks next to them, in a gas station. Mind you, he's from out of town, but he comes, he parks next to them, and he, you know, says to them, can you roll down your music, right? And one of the people in the car says, okay, turns down the music. Jordan Davis, again, being a teenager, says in response, well, no, we don't have any obligation to turn our music down. And, you know, he turns it back up. And next thing you know, the, you know, white gentleman gets out of his car and proceeds to shoot into the car and kills Jordan Davis for playing, you know, his music. It's that kind of vigilantism that is terrifying on every layer imaginable. And one of the things that I sort of draw an analogy to in the book is the ways in which police officers in a blue uniform have perpetuated violence against the Tamir Rices, the Mike Browns, and repeatedly are exonerated or not held accountable. It sends a message, right, to the rest of civilian society that indeed Black children must be, you know, dangerous and violent, and that it's okay to defend yourself and protect yourself in these moments, not realizing the ways in which they manipulate these stories. I mean, there was Tamir Rice, 12 years old, absolutely nothing threatening about him, playing with a toy gun. Jordan Davis, same thing, you know, no prior contact, no way to demonize him. His mother is actually, you know, now, you know, a congresswoman. Like, it's just, it's not. And let me be clear, when I talk about these children not having any prior record, that, you know, look, even if they did, doesn't justify the type of an intervention, violent and punitive interventions that we for so many Black children.
I appreciate that as someone with a record. You know, yeah. I'd prefer if everyone didn't look at me as fair game simply because I was arrested before many years ago.
Right. Right. That's right. Nobody's as bad as the worst thing they've ever done. Right.
I hope not. You talk about people being arrested, convicted, sometimes beaten, and even killed by stereotype. You know, in a sense, you could argue, in a way, you know, that's kind of the, you know, another way you could look at the cover is that, you know, there's a cutout of how everybody sees each person who's black and brown, and they fit everyone to that kind of stereotype.
That's right.
In a sense, you could even argue maybe that's one of the central kind of theses of the book. Am I kind of getting that right?
Yes, I love it. I love it. You're like my analytical hero here. No, but absolutely right. The ways in which, and it goes to this implicit bias, right? Like the ways in which Black children have been reduced to sort of this reductionist approach to Black children must all be the same, right? It's the same thing with like music, the assumption that all rap is the same, right? All hip hop music is the same. When in fact, even within rap music, there are multiple sort of genres. In the same way, there are multiple genres within country music. There's dirty country and, you know, so like, but we tend to over essentialize, you know, Blackness and Black children in particular in ways that dehumanize them and criminalize all Black children. And that's the, in part, the root of these racial disparities, both in the arrest, prosecution, detention, and use of force against Black children.
I think another kind of question that I don't know if the book, in a sense, the book asks it, I'm not sure if it answers it, but this is something I think about a lot, is what is equal justice? I've thought about this a lot because I tend to think what we should be asking for is equal mercy instead of equal punishment. You know, a lot of times people say, you know, like there's a lot of examples we've gone through like this, you know, hippies didn't get this criminalization.
Right.
So why should, right. And people's tendency is to say, let's make everyone get the same punishment. I think Tom Cotton most famously said, let's not get rid of mandatory minimums. Let's just make sure that everybody gets harsh sentences. Oh, you know?
No. Right. I see.
And my thinking is if you do that, you're just going to continue to ramp up the amount of punishment that everybody gets. That's the way it tends to work. It's like, you know, we just keep turning the dial up and, you know, so what I want is equal mercy, not equal punishment. But to some extent, that's easy for me to say, because, you know, I'm a white guy who did a very short sentence. I guess I just think that equal punishment tends to serve the same narratives and stereotypes that we're trying to break down here. I suspect that you probably struggle with this a bit yourself. How do we find actual justice? Where is actual justice?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Josh, that it's a little bit, in my view, easier to talk about what equity would look like when we're talking about children in the legal system, right? And that is, I would argue, for a developmental equity framework, which is not a punitive framework at all. And that we as a country have decided to have separate juvenile courts for children who make mistakes and commit offenses. And that the philosophy of
trying to make as few of them eligible for it as possible, but yes.
Right, exactly.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Yes, exactly, by transferring kids to adult court, making exceptions to the juvenile court rule. But here's the deal, right? But the juvenile court is alive and kicking, and that the fundamental philosophy behind juvenile court is a rehabilitative approach. It's not meant to be punitive at all. And in the last, you know, quarter of a century, last 25 years, we now know more about the adolescent brain than we ever did before, right? And adolescent key features of what they call social, the social psychology of adolescence, more than we ever did before. And that research leads us to two places. One, diminished culpability of children. Right? So that the mitigating effects or the mitigating benefits, if you will, of adolescence bode in favor of less harsh, less punitive sentences. So our Supreme Court has declared that the death penalty although we did it so incredibly late compared to other countries, but that the death penalty is inappropriate for a person who commits a crime under the age of 18, that even juvenile life without the possibility of parole is inappropriate for all people who commit crimes under the age of non-homicide crimes under the age of 18. And then even mandatory life without parole is cruel and unusual punishment, even in homicide cases for children, right? So there's this notion of, we know that children are less culpable for all the features. And guess what? They're also more amenable to rehabilitation. I wanted to belabor that point, give you that detail, because that's the foundation of developmental equity. We have decided that as a country. Now, what the data shows is what you were getting to, which is that we make exceptions, and the exceptions fall disproportionately on Black and Latino children. So when you get into these severe sentences, the more severe the sentence, the greater the racial disparity is. So you think about juvenile life without parole, or the notion of life without parole for a child, right? As if they can never be salvaged, as if they can never be redeemed, which just the science just does not support that proposition. That you're talking then, when people make that decision, they're talking about Black and brown children. And then the final point I'll make is, somebody did an empirical study on that. Anita Raton did this study in which it's called the fragility of innocence, right? Where they gave a factual scenario to participants in the study. And it was actually the factual scenario was straight out of one of those life without parole cases. And it was about a teenager who had committed this brutal rape of an elderly woman. And in the fact pattern, they manipulated the race of the participants. So some, let's say half of the participants got the same scenario with a Black child, and then the other half got it with a white child. Every single person was given information about adolescent, the mitigating features of adolescence and the alternative rehabilitative responses to adolescence. So everybody had the same knowledge about adolescence, but guess who decided, who was in favor of severe life without parole sentences? It was those participants who believed the kids were Black. When they believed that the kids were white, they were in favor of these alternative approaches, these rehabilitative approaches to white children who engaged in the exact same factual behavior. So that just shows you how we're willing to give the developmental benefits, the mitigation to white youth, but not to Black youth.
But there's also, and I think that actually brings the other problem to bear, you know, which is, you know, we started this thing talking about, like, Tamir Rice. You and I see Tamir Rice and we go, how could anyone shoot that kid? The officer clearly saw Tamir Rice and said, that kid's dangerous, I better shoot him. You know, we can come up with a million different ways. You know, we've seen all across the country, even men, you know, school boards where people are getting up and screaming about even the existence of racism. But, you know, I think you and I would probably come up with thousands of examples that we see almost every day that seem overtly, if not, you know, systemically racist, pretty damn close all the time. You know, there seems to be a serious disconnect, and we can pass policy after policy after policy, but how do we get to that cultural reality?
Yeah.
You know, and this is obviously the $1 million question for everyone who deals with these issues, but what's your kind of take on how we start to see, how do people start to see a kid is a kid and not as a target again?
Yeah, I mean, and you're absolutely right. I say that all the time. It is the ultimate question. It's a question of cultural shift, right? It's a question of how do we as a country get the world to see Black children as children too. And I think, you know, there are several things. We're not, you know, I mean, the quintessential piece is really understanding other people's story and other people's reality. And so, as Bryan Stevenson would say, getting proximate with those young people that you're afraid of, such that you really begin to see them as just as your own children, as you would see your own children, right? So stripping off the fear and the secrecy and the veil of danger and threat, because you get to know them, you see them laugh and you see them thrive in the way that your own children do. One of the ways to do that, to get proximate, right? I like to say this, a psychologist friend taught me this once, was, and I just loved it, is the idea that every single child needs at least one irrationally caring adult in their lives. And that a child would do even better to have a team of irrationally caring adults. And so what does that mean? It means that we all make mistakes, and we especially made mistakes during our teenage years, but that I will support you and redirect you and, you know, give you alternative course to get you, you know, to help you move away from that mistake, but I'm still going to care for you. I'm not going to embarrass you, humiliate you, criminalize you, lock you under a jail, but I'm going to do everything that I can to support you. Irrationally caring adult, just like a parent is with their own child. Even when a child does something stupid, they still care about them. And so I think that's part of how we get to that cultural shift.
My friend Amanda Alexander always talks about the power of dreaming big and of having freedom dreams. This season, I'm asking folks what dreams they have about changing our system. Do you have any freedom dreams you'd like to share with us? Aside from the ones we've already discussed.
I think I got to circle back to where I started. It's like, let kids be kids, and especially let Black kids be kids. And so I think that's one dream. And I think another dream is we have to radically reduce the footprint of police in the lives of all children, but especially Black children who have been so disproportionately targeted, even by presence. Even we really have to, as a country, stop relying on traditional law enforcement strategies and policing to do those things that we don't need police officers to do, right? It's not an abolitionist argument. This is an argument, let's relieve police officers of those duties that they don't need, like regulating adolescents or like, you know, handling drug addiction and mental illness, relieve them of those duties so that they can do what we really need them to do and what they're uniquely trained to do, which is to, you know, investigate offenses in fair and equitable.
Yeah. I mean, reading this book, a lot of the books I read make me kind of grumpy, frustrated, and angry, but yeah, this is one of them that made me angry. Usually I ask about hobbies, and if you have any hobbies, feel free to talk about those. But I also just wonder, like, how did you writing this book, a book that has this many stories that could make you feel, everything from cynical to angry to hopeless, how did you deal with it from a self-care perspective?
Yeah, it's a good question, because this was indeed extraordinarily hard to write. It's hard to be a Black woman in America and not have some direct, contact with the criminal legal system, whether it's a cousin, a nephew, a neighbor, somebody. And that's certainly true for me. My brother was in the system. And so I found myself unexpectedly having to psychologically relive some of that. And that appears in the book. I also found that as I went back and revisited some of my clients' stories, that I was experiencing some level of secondary trauma in ways that also were shocking to me. And I kept thinking to myself, if it's this traumatic for me on review, right? Imagine how even more traumatic it was in the moment for the young person. So all that to say, just affirming what you said about how difficult was it to write. And I think for me, it's a function of, faith that there will be reform eventually, that we have to stay the course, as Martin Luther King, said, the arc of justice, the moral arc of justice is long, but it leans, or the moral arc of the universe, is long, but it leans towards justice. And so I have to believe that.
I try.
I know, right?
I work hard to keep believing it, but some days I'm not so sure,
Yep. I hear you. I have those days too. Let's be clear.
I know you wrote a book. We're talking about your book, but I also like to ask people if there are any criminal justice related books that they like and might recommend to our listeners. Do you have any other favorite books aside from your own?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. You know, Chokehold by Paul Butler. Basically, his premise is this is the way the system works exactly as how it was designed to work. I think it's a very powerful statement. I would put on the list for sure James Forman's book, Locking Up Our Own.
One of the first good interviews I had, that was nice enough to come on the podcast was to talk about.
Oh, great. I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah. He's a good friend. So definitely his book, Policing the Black Man, which is an anthology edited by Angela Davis. I would recommend that one. And of course, you know, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. So that's a lot of those that have been really influential in my thinking.
And how would you recommend people find your book? And feel free to say the title again so everyone gets it.
Absolutely. The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. And it is truly available wherever books are sold, the big box stores, as well as the independent bookstores. Also, if you go to my website, rageofinnocence.com. rageofinnocence.com. You can find more about the book, more about the work that I'm doing at Georgetown Law School in partnership with a number of organizations like the Galt Center to really resist some of the racial disparities and racial injustice in the juvenile legal system, our Ambassadors for Racial Justice program, our Racial Justice Toolkit, our Racial Justice Training Series. We have a lot of programs that we're trying to take this book and actualize reform. What does reform look like? But The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth. We talk a lot in this country about the need for police reform, but the need for police reform around children in particular, and Black children in particular, requires a special talent. And so that's what this book does.
I always ask the same last question. What did I mess up? What question should I have asked, but did not?
None at all. I think you got it. No, I think that's right. I'll say this maybe is my last point, which is that, you know, this book weaves together stories, so that this book is about giving voice to children who have been impacted by this criminalization and hyper-surveillance and dehumanizing punitive responses, even to their mistakes. And I weave those stories together with the research and the data in what I hope will be plain language. So it's a mass press book. It's meant for everyone. It's not an academic legal text only. So I hope that folks will be interested in reading.
Yeah, I think one of the really powerful things about the book is you do a great job of presenting stories, but backing it up with all the data. I know you're at Georgetown Law, so you know if you get a chance to say hi to my friend Sean Hopwood, please do.
Oh, definitely.
And thanks so much for doing this. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, all right, you too. Thank you so much for having me, Josh, and for having this podcast that covers so many of the books on the criminal legal system and the juvenile legal system. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks. And now my take. I won't deny it. I'm starting to get a little bit worried about the state of things. In just a few weeks or months, the Supreme Court is about to announce that Roe v. Wade has been overturned, and millions of women will wake up finding out that something that had been considered a fundamental right only days before, and for most of their entire lives, will be criminalized only a few days later. A cadre of true believers spent decades circling the wagons and figuring out how to lever geography to subvert the majority opinion, use their access to the presidency whenever they had it to pack the courts and the Supreme Court, and to do all this while at the same time convincing a large number of Americans that the mostly moderate to a fault Democratic Party were the real radicals. And now I think we find ourselves at a real inflection point and at risk of heading in a direction we won't soon be able to come back from. This is a group of people who've been able to convince huge numbers of what appear to be mostly elderly voters that the black people are the real racists, that white people are really the ones who are oppressed,
that anti-Black racism doesn't exist, that homophobia is a good thing, and that the real problems we have could all be fixed if we could only send women back to the kitchen. They believe that all of this could be even better if women stopped having jobs, were denied birth control, and weren't allowed to have abortions and started instead to have more babies. I totally understand that people have different opinions about abortion, but these folks are getting into seriously terrifying territory, and they are very serious. In the hands of someone like a Ron DeSantis, who, if allowed, I'm pretty sure would take great glee in running down his political enemies with tanks, or a second Donald Trump term with a newly elected and revanchist GOP majority in both houses of Congress, God help us all. Look, say what you will about the Democrats. They are wildly timid and moderate to a fault, but they have no ambition to messianic power. While almost every single person in this new GOP seems to want nothing more than total power and actually think that anyone who disagrees with them is probably not worthy of legal personhood, much less legal protections. We're going to have to stand up and make a stand very soon. These people are coming. They've been organizing for decades, and they are very serious. Sorry to be so pessimistic, but we're getting to the point where this is about the survival of most everything most of us care about. And certainly, the people most vulnerable are going to be people who are justice impacted in a world in which fear on crime is one of the prime touchstones for most of these folks. And I'm not sure what to do, but I do know it's really just about time for all of us to get together and start to do whatever we can. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/decarcerationnation. For those of you who prefer a one-time donation, you can now go to our website and give a one-time donation. Thanks to all of you who have joined us from Patreon or who have given a donation. You can also support us in other non-monetary ways by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or add us on Stitcher, Spotify, or from your favorite podcast app. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, to Ann Espo for helping out with our transcripts and social media images, and Alex Mayo, who helps with our website. Make sure and add us on social media and share our posts across your networks. Also, thanks to my employer, Safe and Just Michigan, for helping to support the Decarceration Nation podcast. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.